My dear listeners, when we cast our eyes towards the boundless sky above, we find ourselves caught in a profound contemplation about our place within the vast fabric of the universe. In this cosmic theater, we are just stardust, intricately connected to the celestial dance that surrounds us. As we reflect on the poetic words of Carl Sagan, we are a way for the cosmos to know itself. We are constantly reminded that our existence, our consciousness, is a remarkable conduit through which the universe can perceive and comprehend its own magnificence. Astronomers speak for the unknown, and the art of communicating the unknown, my dear listeners, I've always believed, is a mastery in itself. For the first episode of Breaking the Facts Season 4, Art of SciComm, I have with me the exceptional Dr. Haley Wall, whose expertise in physics and passion for science communication has propelled her on an incredible journey. Currently, she serves as a science writer at MIT's Lincoln Laboratory. She's become a guiding voice, sharing the groundbreaking advancements of various research groups through her work in the internal newsletter. During her doctoral studies in West Virginia University, Haley embarked on a profound exploration of millisecond pulses, unraveling the mysteries of their polarization and its implication for interstellar medium and gravitational waves. Her fascination with pulses ignited during her undergrad years at University of Vermont, where she focused on pulsar swooshes, further fueling her passion in this captivating field. But beyond academia, Haley is dedicated to science communication. As part of a renowned AstroBytes team, she skillfully translated complex scientific paper into accessible summaries for general public. In her role as the American Astronomical Society Media Fellow, she contributed to AAS NOVA and engaged in press-related activities, solidifying her commitment to make science accessible and inspiring for everyone. Haley Wall's impacts extend beyond boundaries of her research. Through writing, she fosters a greater understanding and passion for science communication, bridging the gap between scientific discoveries and wider community. Get ready to be inspired by her wealth of knowledge, infectious enthusiasm, and unwavering dedication to bridge this gap of science communication. This is a conversation you wouldn't want to miss.
There we go.
All right. So I just introduced Haley to my listeners right now, and I think she would introduce herself. She's a brilliant human, and I'm so glad that she's here with me right now. And I remember having the first conversation with Haley, and I was just like, my God, the entire conversation made my day. And she's also a dog person, which makes her even more adorable. And I will link all of her articles in the description of the episode, and I will link her Twitter profile. Please do go follow her. She's an amazing, amazing person. And whenever you need dog pics, just DM her. So can you please, Haley, introduce yourself to my listeners and the academic community in India?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for the intro. I really love that first conversation too, and I'm really glad that we got connected on Twitter. And yes, I do have a dog. I will talk about her. So if you need pictures, feel free to DM me. So I'm Haley. I got my bachelor's in physics at the University of Vermont, where I did astronomy research. And so I guess I'm an astrophysicist now. But then I moved on to graduate school at West Virginia University, where I got my master's and my PhD, also studying the same type of star. It's called a pulsar. It's a really, really dense neutron star. So after a massive star ends its life, it goes supernova and sheds its outer layers. And then what's left behind, it's this really dense core. And so these things are so dense that a teaspoon would weigh as much as Mount Everest. And so they're crazy stars, and they do really cool things. And I studied them in graduate school. And so during graduate school, I didn't just do research. I also wrote for AstroBytes, which is a site where graduate students just come together to write about scientific papers and take them and kind of condense them into bite-sized summaries that the general public can understand. And so I applied at the very last minute, and it was, hey, I like astronomy, I like writing. And it ended up completely changing my career path And I wrote these scientific summaries. Our listeners can't see my cat right now, who is my computer.
I think the listeners cannot see your cat, so it's fine.
So I wrote for Astrobytes, and then I started writing, I think my second or my third year. And then during my last year, I was an American Astronomical Society Media Fellow, where I continued science writing. And during the course of my research, I kind of decided that research wasn't really my thing, that I was more, and my skills were more fit for another field. And so that happened to be science writing. And so just general, you know, making science more accessible to people. And so in my fourth year, my fifth year, my final one, I started looking for jobs in science writing, started chatting with people. And now I am a science writer for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, for their Lincoln Laboratory, which is like a national security lab. And so I write for their internal newsletter and I love it. It's really fantastic. And so making that jump from academia to science writing was a little bit tricky, but I find it incredibly rewarding. And I am really happy in my career right now. So outside of work in my free time, which I actually have a lot of now, I like to exercise. I run a lot. I do jigsaw puzzles. I'm currently doing one from the company Startorialist, which is like this big fashion website with astronomy. And I also have a dog. Her name is Jocelyn Bell. So Jocelyn Bell was the amazing woman who discovered pulsars. And so her name is spelled, last name is spelled B-E-L-L, but my dog's name is B-E-L-L-E. And so it's a combination of pulsars and also my favorite Disney movie, Beauty and the Beast. And so we just call her Belle. And she is just turned 6 months the other day. And she is golden retriever.
And she's adorable. And so are you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And I don't know, Harry, something about you is just so positive.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, like just talking to you just is rewarding itself. Let me just put it that way. Yeah. Okay. So I just wanted to ask, since you mentioned that, you know, you are a doctor now, and congratulations on that. So, you know, I can ask this question, which a lot of people have asked you, you know, that, you know, PhD is all about, you know, putting in hard work and a lot of, there's no work-life balance, mental health just gets disregarded. And, you know, in your opinion, as we say, like in your professional PhD journey, what all did you think, you know, you'd heard about, yeah, these things will happen in your PhD, right? And then suddenly when you started to, you know, do it, what all stereotypical notions that we have about PhD and that we read online as well met true to you? Like, you felt that you know, that is true. Or maybe, no, that is not how PhD is supposed to be. This is bad. So, yeah, what do you think about that?
Yeah, so for me, just the culture of academia itself is an interesting one. And there's this notion in academia where you have to work all the time. It's if you don't work from the second you get up and then stay up really late, then you're doing it wrong. If you don't, you know, hard work is definitely rewarded, but overwork is glorified. And so if you only got 2 hours of sleep because you were up all night on a problem set, some people brag about that, when in reality, that's not healthy. But again, it's glorified. And it's something that you should strive for. And that really easily leads to burnout. And that's something that I was absolutely aware of. I pushed myself really hard at the end of undergrad and ended up completely burning out. I was diagnosed with anxiety and it was really not good. And so I came into grad school completely surrounded by that culture, but really wanting to actually have a work-life balance. And so I made that a goal of mine. I wouldn't work past 5 or 6 p.m. unless I absolutely had to. And so would I have gotten maybe one more paper out of my PhD if I hadn't had work-life balance? Maybe. Would I have completely burned myself out? Also, absolutely. And so there is definitely the struggle of being surrounded by that culture and being surrounded by people who are going to work 24/7 and do more than you. And it's really hard to combat. But That's something that I definitely advocate for. It's work-life balance, is taking care of yourself. It's not, you know, it's seeing, you know, eating three meals a day, going for a walk and getting a lot of sleep as doing well. It's not, oh, I published, you know, six papers this year. I think that you also need to keep in mind things like, are you getting enough sleep? Are you maintaining your relationships? And so different parts of your life can suffer if you overwork, and, you know, some people are fine with working all the time, and that's great. But I think a lot of people definitely need that balance. And during grad school, I would, you know, work my 8-9 hours a day and then come home and exercise and, you know, read at night and such. And so just becoming okay with that and, you know, making sure to prioritize work-life balance is something that I did in graduate school, and why I didn't burn out. And also kind of one of the reasons that I wanted to leave academia was because you're surrounded by this culture so much. And that's not something that I, you know, even though I had combated it, it's not really something, a culture that I wanted to continue to be around.
Yeah, I completely understand. Sometimes I as well, you know, in the notion of, you know, yeah, this is exactly what a lot of people talk about when they are enrolled in grad school, that, you know, getting proper 8 hours sleep is actually a sin. Basically, you're not working towards what you want. And experimenters stay up all night sometimes to make sure that experiments are okay. And the next day, they are supposed to be present in front of their PI as if nothing has happened. As if sleep deprivation doesn't do anything to experimenters. Which is completely insane, because sleep is very important.
Exactly.
And having a work-life balance is extremely important. And I don't know about the US, but the pay that you get in India when you are doing PhD is extremely low. And sometimes for months and months, it gets stuck by the government. And then suddenly they will give you. But what about those months when you are running out of money and you are in your late 20s and then you have to ask your parents for money? Instead, you should be financially supporting your family. So it becomes very difficult, you know. And I mean, I applaud PhD researchers because, you know, they lose a lot, you know, they sacrifice a lot, and their family as well, to right. do something that they really love. But then the culture itself is really messed up, even here.
Yep.
I don't know how we can help it. So
yeah, I mean, one of the things that I found about being a grad student that was tough was looking at my friends who weren't in academia, looking at my friends who, you know, went straight out of undergrad into a career. And for the last 5 years, they've been saving for retirement, saving for a house, starting families, getting married. Whereas as a grad student, you're not paid that much. And so some people do start families in grad school, but that's, you know, not something that people, you know, that I could afford, or, you know, I couldn't afford a house in graduate school. I wasn't saving anything. I was making enough, but I wasn't able to save for retirement or anything like that. And so you end up feeling, I know it's hard not to compare yourself to others. It's hard not feeling like you're totally behind in your life. And so that was one of the things that I definitely struggled with in graduate school. You're kind of stunted. So you come out at the end and you know, you don't know about retirement, you know, health insurance, you need to find that out and all these things. And, you know, you look at your friends and they have a house, and it can be tough. You know, yes, you got a PhD at the end of those 5 years, but in terms of like actual things in life, I know success is measured differently and all this stuff, but it's hard not to compare yourself to those people.
Yeah, I completely relate. So if I enroll myself in grad school, I know a lot of my friends who are right now doing entrepreneurship or who are in economics right now, my sister, let's just say. So she will be way ahead financially, and I know that, and she will be way more aware about the government rules and regulations, where I'll just be like, you know. So PhD is like, I think it's sort of like going into a cave and then, you know, just detaching from all the things that is happening around you, right? And I mean, it can be tough. It can be very tough. That's why I applaud whoever does a PhD, because Absolutely. It takes a lot of time. So yeah. And one more thing, we talk about this concept of shiny tower of academia, and like all the people, let's just say they are involved in a laboratory, and the research never goes out. So And we are doing research for the layman. They are paying us. We are getting funds through them. But then only 1% of the population can understand what we actually do. So, you know, now that you have attained PhD, congratulations again. So how much do you agree with the statement that I just made, you know, that, you know, science is kept with the highest ranking journals right now. And even to publish a paper, you need to pay thousands of dollars. And in like a third world nation like ours, with less funds and even, you know, less motivation to publish papers. I mean, sometimes researchers have to take a loan just to get their papers published in Nature. That's how the situation is. So do you think that whatever I said is true now that, you know, now that you have attained PhD, how much do you agree with what I just said?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting question, and definitely leads to a really great segue. So I do agree that, it, you know, it's a ton of money to publish papers, and that's, it's definitely a rising cost. But I also agree that the science can be locked up in papers, and it can be really hard for people to understand. But that's where people like me come in, the science communicators. And so my job is to take that research and disseminate it to people, essentially. It's to take everything that I've learned in my PhD and how to synthesize information. And essentially, basically what a PhD teaches you is how to Google things. I'm really good at Googling things. And so just how to find that information and how to, you know, how to translate it. And so science communicators, I think of as translators, you take all of the science that's locked up in these papers. You know, if you want to read about Betelgeuse dimming or, you know, the latest supernova, you might have to go to a paper. And who's going to want to read, you know, what average person is going to want to read a 20-page paper with figures and math? Probably no one. And so you can't get access to that. And so what I started doing in Astrobytes actually is taking that information in the papers and again using my skills, my familiarity with that, and being able to communicate it to people. And so that's one way that people are getting information. You're having people like all of the science communicators that are taking it and putting it different ways. And some people make TikTok, some people write articles, some people make Twitter threads. And so they're really making that information understandable. And so I, you know, I guess I'm one of those science communicators, but also I admire other people that do it in different ways. And so I think that, yes, that is true that the science is kept in the journals, but there are also people who are definitely making more of an effort, especially in the days of social media, of being able to disseminate that information.
Yeah. I mean, how did you come up with joining Astrobytes? Like, I know this is a very generic question and you just like, you know, you mentioned it, like I was casually applying, but there must be something like a driving force within you that said, oh, I really want to, you know, do something. Why should this research be kept within me? Right.
I mean, for Astrobytes, it actually wasn't. So I started my science communication journey, I guess, working at a planetarium. And so there was just a planetarium at the top of my physics building. And I always loved stargazing. And so like, it was a chance to teach people about the stars. And so I created these little introductions about Messier objects. And I taught people about the constellations and really fell in love with that and really fell in love with teaching just astronomy in general and outreach and answering kindergartners' questions about the constellations and sixth graders' questions about black holes. And so I really kind of fell in love with that. But unfortunately, actually, it is exactly what you say. It's just I applied for Astrobytes on a whim, not really knowing what it was. I applied at the last minute. I didn't tell anybody that I was doing it. I think my fiance was away on a work trip at the time. And didn't tell anybody, you know, kept it a secret, just wrote the Astrobyte. And then a couple of weeks later, I happened to get in. And then I joined the amazing community that is Astrobytes and found out that it isn't just summarizing papers. It's doing all of the work that Astrobytes does. It's education studies and it's diversity and inclusion things like our Black and Astro series, which has been really great. And just different things like that. And so yeah, it was kind of on a whim, but it was motivated by the desire to get that information out. And so since Astrobytes, I have found different ways to communicate science. I did a series on Twitter called, it was hashtag Pulsar Friday. And so I would teach about all of these topics that was secretly writing my thesis introduction for me. It kind of like went through the list of topics writing that. But it was doing Twitter threads and it was doing GIFs and it was really digging deep into these topics and figuring out how to make them more accessible. And then there was my passion project, which is called the Pulsars and Profiterol Project. Profiterol is a cream puff. And so I love the Great British Baking Show. And so I would take a technical challenge from the Great British Baking Show and bake it and then like make it into the shape of a pulsar and then write about some kind of aspect of pulsar science. So if it would, you know, I think I made fortune cookies one time and then put them in the shape of, I talked about binary pulsars. And, you know, put two fortune cookies down, made them look like pulsars and talked about binary pulsars. And so that was a really fun way for me to connect baking and science and try to make it accessible. And, you know, people who watch a Great British Baking Show might click on that link and learn a little bit about science. And so I found different ways to communicate that science and really fell in love with it. And that's why I went after a science writing position. I really loved being that bridge between the scientists and the public and just taking that science and translating it into something that people could understand and relate to.
Yeah. And when you do that, I mean, essentially when a layman looks at a particular paper, they get confused. They're like, oh my God, what are these jargons? What are these terms? Yep. But then if a person can tell them that, hey, it's pretty simple. It's just like mac and cheese. Just look at it. You'll figure it out. I think, and the ethics of academia also holds here, right? Because research shouldn't be bound by these 1% elite people, the professors and the laboratory technicians, and obviously the PhD students, but also to the other people who are involved. There are cleaning ladies that come into our labs, and they are also very curious, you know, what are you doing? What are you feeding these flies? Let us know. And I have to tell them, look at this. This is so cool. This is so amazing. And then they're like, oh, this is pretty simple. I thought, you know, this is a very complicated thing to do. Or when you're running a gel, protein gel, they ask even that, you know, oh my God, what is this? And you just tell them, oh, it's just agar. You just pour it and it just comes up. So electrophoresis, that's fine. So yeah, like, and they're very interested. It's not that they're not. And when we break down, like, all these stereotypical notions that, you know, that people have about, you know, oh my God, physics is so bad, or oh my God, math is so terrifying, which I have still in me. I cannot do math at all. And my sister is excellent in math, and so is my partner. But yeah, it's crazy. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's part of the challenge. It's my job at Lincoln Lab is writing, again, I write the newsletter, which goes out to everybody. And so taking these really technical staff seminars and writing them so that not only the researchers with PhDs, but also people in different departments like finance and HR can understand them. It's really a challenge, but it's a worthy challenge. It's really fun. And I really enjoy it. It's trying to break that down and make it accessible for people at all levels.
It's fun. I know. You are such an amazing person. Obviously people listen to you, Haley. Come on. So yeah, this covers the question, you know, why is it important to cover, like, to think out of the box, you know, because you did and you ended up in such a good position and you're happy, and what else could you ask for, right? I mean, that single decision that you made to apply to Astrobytes might just probably turn out to be one of the best decisions in your life.
Absolutely.
And I think you love your job. It's pretty evident.
It's great.
Yeah, your love for science, and I mean, you cover astronomy, or you also cover other articles when you summarize them. When you used to summarize for Astrobytes, I know it's just like, I think astronomy articles there, because Astrobytes is specifically for that. And what a brilliant organization, by the way. I really loved it. Yeah, I still do. And I follow Astrobytes. They have these other sites also, I guess.
Yes, there are a ton of science bites.
There are Mathstat Bytes, and then there is for political science as well. There's PolSci Bytes. Then for SciComm, there's SciComm Bytes. So all these people come together, and it was a really great initiative. But it started with Astrobytes. I remember that. Yeah. And you worked for it. And look where you are now.
I did. Happy. Yeah. It was fantastic.
All happy with a beautiful dog and cats.
Yeah. I mean, it was a lot of work getting here, but, you know, it was great. But yeah, with my career, so Lincoln Laboratory is primarily national security. And so everything that we do, so within academia, you're kind of just doing science for science. But the unique thing about Lincoln Laboratory is we're trying to develop things for national security. And so we have different groups. And so I write about all of these things. You can just find on the website that there's an engineering group, there's cybersecurity, biotechnology and human systems. And so I learn about a lot of different things. And I do miss astronomy. There was a recent AAAS conference that I was really sad that I couldn't go to, but it's also using this physics knowledge in order to cover different things. And again, at my job, I'm constantly learning about brand new things. And sometimes a talk will be really physics-y and I'll understand a lot. Sometimes I won't really understand a lot. And, but it's just using those skills from my PhD, the synthesizing information, the knowing where to find things, knowing the right questions to ask. And so that's what really, really helped me in my career. And so just when you mentioned thinking out of the box, it's when I decided that I didn't want to go into academia, I kind of started making a list of things that I wanted in a career and things that I didn't want. So I didn't want to code. I don't like coding. But I did like writing and I did like communicating. And so just figuring out what you did learn from your PhD that, you know, it's, I guess it's technically in a PhD in physics, but it was really kind of astronomy, but okay. You learned about the stars. Okay. You know a lot about pulsars, but what else do you know? You know how to write, you know how to synthesize information, you know how to present your work. And so just really, really kind of thinking, what can I do with this? There are a lot of people that go from physics PhDs into data science. And so that's a booming field. And just figuring out, you know, it doesn't, your job doesn't have to involve physics or astronomy. It can be, again, data science, but it's just recognizing that the things that you did learn from your PhD and kind of the soft skills and kind of knowing where those translate. So I think that one of the best things that happened in Astrobytes was somebody recommended me as the head of the editorial committee. And so I had never thought, yes, let's do editorial work. Absolutely. But through that, I really learned that I liked helping people organize posts and editing. And so just through that, I really enjoyed that. I really realized that my skill set was more kind of leaning toward that area and writing and editorial. And it wasn't that I wasn't cut out for academia. I didn't choose to go the non-academic route because maybe I wasn't cut out for academia. Maybe that was the case, but it's just realizing that it's not a failure if you don't go into academia. It's my skill set is better somewhere else. My interests are suited for something else. And so that's kind of one thing that I really had to overcome when I was taking this job at Lincoln Laboratory. It's, you know, yes, I'm not going to academia. I'm not going into a postdoc. Sometimes academia teaches you how to go into academia. It teaches you that a postdoc is the next step. And then you go in a tenure track. And yes, I'd had a dream to be a professor essentially since I started undergrad, but that's not where my skill set and my interests lie. I had been trained as an academic, but I had discovered all of these things that I also enjoyed. So that was one thing that I kind of got off topic, but that was one thing that I recognized. It's not a failure if you go from a PhD into industry or whatever. If you don't follow the typical academic track, it just means that your skills are better suited for somewhere else and you can thrive in a different environment.
You know, I needed to hear this, and so did my friends right now. And let me tell you, Haley, I am proud of you.
Oh, thank you.
And I am so proud that you said this, because right now we all are in that, you know, last semester fuss, people are applying like anything, and there's this pressure, you know, if you don't get into a university, you're essentially a failure. You know, you are already in a research institute. I mean, you should be getting into a grad school by now. And my friends are getting rejections after rejections because PhD is a very competitive field now. So, yeah, I mean, I really need to hear this. People need to hear this. Thank you for saying it. And I'm proud of you. Oh, and you're adorable.
Thank you.
So, okay, one more question, Hayley.
Sure.
I think my listeners have known a little bit about mental death effect before because I have talked about it. It's like a systematic underrecognition of women scientists in any field, whatever field of research that they do. For example, like if somebody discovers something and they identify as a woman, and they're like just like, you know, like just thrown away, not even recognized in the papers, or because of, you know, their identification as a woman, that, you know, I'm a woman in STEM, and they're just like, okay, now we will not recognize your research because you are a woman, and women are not supposed to be in STEM because this is a uncompetitive field and ruled by men, let's just say that. And in India, that is the case still. I don't know about US right now, but a lot of women have been dropping out of STEM. And mainly it's because they want to start a family. And there's a lot of, you know, pressure around women to start a family after a certain age. And then, I mean, it's bad. It's really bad. So apart from all the factors that come into a PhD, being a woman in STEM, and now that you've completed your research, did you face anything because you were a woman?
Yeah, so I think that just hearing about the culture in India, I think it's slightly different in the US. I think it's getting better in the US, but I definitely still see it. One thing that I was really fortunate to have in undergrad and in graduate school was really strong female mentors. I mean, I also had Jocelyn Bell Burnell to look up to, who is one of the most humble people on the planet and who is just really an amazing person. But I had... I started out, so the how I got into Pulsars is actually kind of funny. I went into undergrad knowing that I wanted to do research because I'd done a program at my high school. And there was one researcher, it was Joanna Rankin, who is now one of my favorite people on the planet. and so she studied pulsars, and I had no idea what that was. I had no idea what a pulsar was, never heard of it, but I did research with her, and she is one of the strongest women in science that I know. She basically wrote the beginning papers on pulsar emission. And so just kind of being academically raised by her and seeing how she dealt with things and how she kind of just kept doing her work and nothing stopped her was really incredible to watch. And that was, you know, becoming a young academic, that's something that I needed to see. And so going into graduate school, I really looked for a really strong female mentor, and I found one in Dr. Maura McLaughlin, who is like the head of NanoGrav and has done a million papers and has a million collaborations. And so that was a strong woman in the field. And so just kind of going from Joanna to Maura was something that I really needed. It was really being told and, you know, seeing that there's nothing that women can't do. And so, I mean, it was definitely hard, you know, not considering research. I went into graduate school, there were, I think, 12 of us going to in my class, and there were two women. And so it was tough to find people who, you know, it was tough to find other girls who you could relate to. And so that was difficult. But again, I think what helped me the most was those really strong female mentors. And I found a lot of kind of along the way, but my two main research advisors, just having pioneering women in the field, really made me believe that there was nothing that I couldn't do despite discrimination around me and all of these issues. It was really being guided by those two females, and that made a huge difference.
It's important to have that in academia. It's very important to have that in academia.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're lucky in that sense because you didn't face any family pressure as well, I believe, to start a family or do anything. But because in like here, it's very difficult to convince your family that, you know, you are still studying and you are underpaid and you're still, you know, studying for a degree that will probably take, they say 5 years, but maybe seven, maybe eight. We never because it doesn't depend on time. It's a research question. It might take years. So You never know. You never know. So, yeah, I mean, but I'm glad that you got your PhD, and I'm glad that we talked. I'm glad that I met you. So, like, any concluding message for the listeners, Hilly, that you have, anything that you want to tell on the top of your head, whatever.
I like that we got, you know, into the fact that academia teaches you to go into academia, but there are so many other fields. There are so many amazing people, especially on Twitter. Twitter is a great resource and something that I relied on in graduate school a lot. And there are people on there who do mental health, and you know, there are other people who do things talking about life outside academia. And so that was kind of a guiding force for me. But just do not give up. There was, you know, just try anything you can not to give up, you know, go seek help if you need it. I absolutely did that in graduate school. Rely on your network. And just take care of yourself. There are going to be some days in your PhD or, you know, in your life where you aren't going to be productive, where you're going to be, maybe you slept badly the night before because of whatever, or, you know, maybe you're sick. And so you're not going to be as productive as you are at all times. And just making sure that you're okay with that. You know, especially this comes into play with when I was writing my thesis in the summer. Some days I had absolutely no motivation and would write like a sentence and just stare at papers all day. And other days I would write, you know, half an introduction. And so just again, taking care of yourself and just recognizing that academics are also human beings. You need sleep, you need meals, you need exercise, and work can be important. It can be a passion, but you also really need to take care of yourself. And so whether that means maybe taking a couple of vacation days or even just taking a nap during the day. I took naps during my PhD pretty much every day. Honestly, taking naps with my cat during my thesis writing was the best part of my PhD. but that got me through thesis writing. But just knowing, you know, whether it's getting a therapist or whether it's, you know, making your favorite meal every Friday night, just really making sure that you take care of yourself and do what you need. Because if you don't do that, then that's going to hamper your productivity. And even though you might be working all the time, you're not going to be as productive because your body doesn't have what it needs in order to be successful. And so I think that you mentioned sleep. That's absolutely something that is vital to me. And I made sure to get 8 hours every night. And that was absolutely vital. But again, one of the most important things that I found during my PhD was do take care of yourself. And so, yeah.
Like, we have to end this now. I don't want to. I just want to keep talking to you.
I can keep chatting with you if you'd like.
But then, thank you, Hailey, for coming and for speaking and being such an adorable person. And I cannot believe how lucky I am that our paths crossed on Twitter. And I tell everyone, you know, like, Twitter is an amazing, amazing place to connect with people. And not just like within community or maybe just in academia, but outside academia also, a lot of amazing individuals are there. So, like, yeah, Twitter is amazing. So, like, I don't know, after Elon took over, I don't know what is happening. But right now, all I know is I am glad that we met on Twitter, and I'm glad we could do this. And I always wanted you to come here and speak anyway. So.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. It was another really fun chat with you. You're a fantastic person and a shining star, and I know that you're going to do amazing things.
Thank you, Ellie.
You're so welcome.
Bye.
Bye.
The realization that we are intimately connected to the vastness of universe is what binds us all. A big, big, big thanks to Hailey for coming and inspiring us to continue to seek knowledge, nurturing curiosity, and to bridge the gap between wonders of cosmos and the wider community. And to you, my dear listeners, I hold nothing but gratitude. Thank you so, so, so much for supporting my journey and making me into a better communicator and a person. I'll see you in the next episode. Till then, stay warm, stay safe, and remember to keep looking up, for the universe is waiting to be known.